You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with a debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including a failed effort to help people experiencing a mental health crisis in Ashland, another budget crisis at SOU, and another shot of cash for the Civic Auditorium in Reading. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Roman Battaglia, politics, science, and environment reporter.
I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
Justin, let's start with you. You had a feature this week checking in on Oregon's pilot peer respite program. First of all, what is peer respite? Explain that to us.
Yeah, so a peer respite is a short-term voluntary residential program for those experiencing a mental health crisis. It usually takes place in a home-like setting. It's non-clinical, so pretty casual. And it's staffed by those with similar experience. So that's the peer aspect. So workers are those who have gone through, you know, their own mental or emotional crisis, and they can help those using the service. And peer respites are talked about often as an alternative to psychiatric hospitalization. It can be a good fit for those who have had bad experiences in that system especially. And it can really just give someone in a hard spot some time where they're safe, they're supported, they can be connected to services. This is short term, usually just for a couple weeks. And research shows it can be really effective. It can save lives. And it can also save money because it's quite expensive to have someone hospitalized. So the idea of peer respites have been around for a few decades now. Other states have them, but not Oregon. And in 2021, or at least in 2021, they weren't in Oregon. And back then, the Oregon legislature passed a bill to fund a peer respite pilot program. It provided $6 million to open four of these centers in different regions in the state.
So that bill passed 5 years ago, as you just said. How did the pilot program turn out?
I would say mixed. So at least in terms of the rollout of the program. So 5 years later, only two respites are up and running. Three organizations, which OHA selected for grants and who, you know, they gave money to, actually never ended up opening centers. And so this feature was about what happened. And I focused on Mountain Beaver House. So they were selected for a $1.5 million grant to open a respite in Jackson County. And from the get-go, they faced a lot of pushback and skepticism from local officials and residents. So for the proposed Mountain Beaver House peer respite, it was actually a group called Stab and Wagon, which applied for the grant. And Stab and Wagon, as I've reported on in the past, is a sort of controversial group in the area. They run a harm reduction van, which provides things like clean needles and pipes and overdose reversal medication. It's also very openly critical of police and, in fact, has a policy of not working with police. So Stab and Wagon originally wanted to open this peer respite in Medford after they were selected for grants, but because they don't have the best reputation with authorities in the city, they decided that would be too hard. So they focused their efforts on Ashland instead, which they thought maybe would be a more welcoming environment for their peer respite.
Okay, so they're trying in Ashland, but it wasn't an easy go, right? They had more problems there.
Yeah, the problems kept coming. So they found a landlord actually in Ashland willing to rent them a house for the center, but they ran into zoning issues. So the peer respite bill didn't include language about local zoning, and Ashland City Council or the Planning Commission really couldn't figure out how to zone this place. Also, their potential neighbors really didn't like the idea of living next to a peer respite. This is the house they found. It's in an upscale neighborhood in Ashland, just above Lithia Park. And those potential neighbors actually put together a petition for them not to open the respite there, for them not to get zoning. And throughout all of this, this process, the staff at Mountain Beaver House say they were also running into problems communicating with their grant administrator at OHA. They weren't receiving the support and direction they say they needed. Eventually, OHA pulled their grant from Stab and Wagon to open Mountain Beaver House because, you know, they couldn't actually open the center. They ran out of time. And then in March, OHA requested those funds that were awarded to Stab and Wagon be given back to OHA. So during this period of well over a year, the group was you know, paying salaries and using the money for preparing to set up the center, and it looks like OHA wants that back.
So is this all OHA's fault, or is this more complicated?
It's more complicated. So Mountain Beaver House blamed basically a few things, but it blamed a lack of communication with OHA and hurdles with zoning and, you know, the neighbors' pushback. But the author of the peer respite bill really blamed OHA for choosing Stab and Wagon in the first place. So the group ran that harm reduction program, like I mentioned, but it didn't really have experience in opening a clinic or providing mental health services. The agency scored applicants for the grant on 8 categories, but no category existed for previous experience or work in a similar field, you know, actually running a mental health operation. And that was part of the criticism, actually, in the beginning by those in Medford when the group first got the grant. People worried they wouldn't be capable of running this.
So Mountain Beaver House wasn't the only group to apply. Were there other groups that had troubles like this?
Yeah, so OHA also pulled a grant from the Portland-based Black Mental Health Organization. The State Department of Justice is actually investigating that group regarding their financial disclosure filings. And OHA also canceled a grant to the Stronghold in Klamath County. That organization had a property, but they couldn't bring it up to code. The Stronghold actually won a lawsuit against a contractor it blamed for that delay. But all of these groups, which failed to open a peer respite, also lacked experience in running something similar. And the two successes from this pilot program are actually with organizations that have a history of working in mental health care.
And you spoke with about running one of these successful peer respites. You spoke to someone there. What did they say?
Right. So two centers were, you know, successfully opened. I spoke with someone at Folk Times Peer Respite in Portland. And Folk Time has been offering peer services for decades, actually, in Oregon. They said also, by the way, they had issues with zoning, even in Portland. But they've been operating for a year now. They've served over 50 people in the peer respite. And they said it's had a really significant impact. The director says he's seen people begin looking for work again after years of unemployment following their stay. Some who would regularly stay at psychiatric hospitals, you know, throughout the year have not needed to reenter facilities since staying in the respite and being connected to other services. So he says it's been a success. You know, and the author of the peer respite bill is still a big believer in peer respites. And basically he told me he hopes the state looks at successes like Folk Time when considering funding the program in the future.
And Justin, why did you do this story? Why did you think it was important?
Well, Oregon, you know, we're very open, it seems, to new ideas and public programs. The state funds a lot of things with pretty good intentions, which will make headlines when those things pass. But I think it's important to check in on what the results actually look like on the ground, especially in rural southern Oregon. You know, things are passed in Salem, and they might work fine in Portland, but, you know, they can face unique challenges down here. This took a while to report, you know, months of back and forth with public records just to, you know, lay out a timeline of what actually happened. It's a complex story, and I don't think there's super easy answers about what went wrong, but
your
best there.
And I think you started reporting on this or requesting records almost a year ago.
Yeah, probably a year ago.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks, Justin. Jane, let's talk about another type of crisis. You reported this week on a budget crisis at Southern Oregon University. What's the news there?
So there was a special Board of Trustees meeting on Monday where they presented a cash flow forecast, which says that by the end of May, the university will drop below its approved cash threshold, which is $12.68 million. SOU also projects it won't have enough cash to make payroll by the end of February 2027. By June of 2027, that shortfall is expected to grow to more than $14 million. So not good news. In terms of why this is happening, you know, the board asked a lot of questions. University leaders said their budget and finance offices are understaffed. Financial reporting to the board is insufficient. Financial policies need strengthening. The vice president of finance says this is a capacity issue, not a competence issue. And they've talked about hiring 2 new budget and finance staff members to help sort of fill in that gap.
And I should mention before we go any farther that SOU does hold the license for JPR, but we cover it just like anyone else.
Yes.
Jane, in my short time here, it seems like SOU has been in a similar position before, this isn't its first budget crisis?
Correct. We've been here before in different ways. So in 2023, the university cut almost 82 full-time equivalent positions in just the fall, September 2025. They approved another plan to cut more than $10 million over 4 years. Between those two plans, President Rick Bailey says SOU has cut one quarter of its faculty and staff in a few years. And in terms of why that's happening, there's concerns about rising costs for benefit programs like retirement and insurance, declining enrollment and retention, inadequate state support. Oregon ranks very low in per-student state funding for public universities, and then the new problems I mentioned above, not having enough staff, and you know the needing to report to the board more often are problems specifically for SOU, I think.
And what is SOU going to do to fix this problem?
So they've implemented a hiring freeze, they've put in travel restrictions, reductions in funding for things like professional development. The main plan is that Rick Bailey is asking the legislature for help. He's been in Salem this week. If that doesn't work out, it's kind of to be determined what the plan is. He says that the university is already exploring funding sources that have pushed that cash flow challenge from May out into the summer, but he didn't really give any details about what those funding sources are. The board had asked for a plan on how SOU is going to address its short-term cash flow needs by the end of the week, which is today. So we'll have to see what the plan is.
Okay. Meanwhile, there's an important bill in the Oregon House right now related to the future of higher education in the state. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that's a bill from State Rep Pam Marsh trying to figure out what the vision is for higher ed in Oregon long term. How do we make it viable and valuable? And so it would direct the state's Higher Education Coordinating Commission to evaluate the objectives of each institution and opportunities for potential collaboration or integration. There was a recent report released by the Higher Education Coordinating Commission talking about public universities that did recommend targeted institutional integration. SOU has kind of pushed back on that report, but President Bailey said at a press conference he's open to discussing this bill and discussing solutions, but he really thinks the legislature needs to stay focused on the funding piece in particular. So we'll have to see what happens with that bill and with SOU's funding plan.
Okay, thanks, Jane. Roman, tell us, what is going on with Reading Civic Auditorium?
Yeah, it's another budget crisis. Now, lots of budget crises.
Lots of good news this week.
Yeah. The Civic Auditorium down in Reading has been at risk of closing. It's was built a long time ago. It used to be run by the city itself, but when the city was dealing with its own financial problems in 2011 amid the recession, they almost closed it down. But this nonprofit, Advance Reading, took it over and began running it themselves. It hosts things like, you know, conventions or concerts, a lot of concerts and other city events and stuff. But in recent years, they've kind of struggled to earn enough revenue just to stay afloat. So they've been looking for some funding support from the city. Last August, the city had already given the auditorium $675,000. But, you know, now they said they needed more money. They had sent a letter to the city saying that if you did not give us money this week, then we were going to have to close by the end of February. And they say they need around $1.5 million a year more to keep from closing.
And why is the Civic Auditorium struggling right now?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The Civic Auditorium has had this kind of unique model from the start when it got taken over by Advance Reading. Back in 2011, it was this local megachurch, Bethel, that actually came forward with the idea to create Advance Reading and take over operations. Bethel basically needed more room for its supernatural school of ministry that they have. So they created Advance Reading as the separate non-religious nonprofit, and then Advance Reading would sublease the space back to Bethel for its ministry. And that earned, you know, a lot of money. I think it made up about 20% of Advance Reading's profit for the auditorium. And that kind of helped them get things up and running with other stuff. But then after the pandemic, enrollment at Bethel School dropped and they no longer needed the space. So they dropped their contract with the auditorium in 2024. And Advance Reading staff say since then, and because of the pandemic, ticket sales have become more volatile and it's been just harder to attract people there. So it's just hard for them to cover all of their expenses. They lost almost $500,000 in the 2024 fiscal year.
And you looked at how other government-owned event spaces like this are run. What did you find there?
Yeah, and part of the reason I looked at that was because that was a point Advance Reading was making, was that this was a very unique contract. I look at other areas like the Lane Event Center, which is owned by the county, gets around $1.5 million in tax revenue for support, and it wouldn't turn a profit on those rentals alone. Same goes for even bigger places like Portland's Convention Center, Keller Auditorium. So, you know, rely on the city's support with tax revenue for stuff, but they generate a lot of tax revenue through hotel taxes and sales taxes and stuff and economic impacts for the city.
And briefly, what did the city council decide?
Yeah, they decided to give another $464,000, and they're going to come back in 3 months and reevaluate things. The city has a lot of strings that were attached that you can read out more about on our website.
Okay, thanks. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.